This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
We come now to the human response. First, the knowledge of God. 2 points under A. The first is to direct your attention to verse 19. To underscore what I said earlier. Point one under the knowledge of God. What may be known about God is plain, for God made it plain to them. That's the first point, verse 19. The second point refers to verse 21. Knowing God, they did not glorify God or give Him thanks. You have here an adverbial participle, nontes, and it's a concessive participle. Or you might argue it's a causal participle. Here's what I mean. You could take verse 21 as the New International Version takes it. Although knowing God, they did not glorify Him. Ponder a second alternative. Because they knew God, they did not glorify Him. In any case, verse 21 witnesses to knowledge of God. That's got to be the starting point. Okay, let's go to the next point. The suppression of truth. Now, the preparation for point B is point A. That is, Paul does not represent ancient humanity beginning in abysmal ignorance and only gradually moving up from that primeval slime into some sort of clarity about the transcendent. Rather, there's first knowledge of God that is then suppressed. 3 points under B. Point number one directs attention to the opening verse of the passage. The wrath of God is being revealed against ungodliness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth. The verb is strong, katecho, who suppress the truth, which implies a prior understanding of it. You don't suppress what you don't know. The second point is to note the means by which this is accomplished. And I direct your attention to that little prepositional phrase that precedes the participle, who suppress the truth by means of their unrighteousness. Instrumental dative of means. This is just startlingly contemporary. Who suppress the truth by means of their iniquity. You know, think about that when you're relating to your most violently pagan friends. Sometimes the most violent attempt to suppress the truth is the immediate prelude to embracing it. Now, this is a last-ditch stand. And I will allow my unrighteousness to multiply because I'm trying to remain deaf to the voice of God. And I'm trying to keep that glory at arm's length. Point three. Paul is speaking not merely of a failure to appreciate truth about God, but of a positive effort to crush it. And we may illustrate by imagining a person going through an art gallery, let's say the National Gallery of Art in Washington, and seeing all those beautiful impressionistic paintings. It's one thing to go through those galleries with a yawn and coming out an hour later and saying, "What a bore." It's another thing to go in there with a knife and start slashing away at the paintings. It's that latter image that applies here. They suppress the truth. This shows the satanic agency of fallen humanity. Satan seeks to undo what God has done. I always think of that the unman in Perelandra who takes a frog and mutilates it, not because he wants to eat it, but literally for the hell of it, simply because it's a beautiful creature and beauty is intolerable. Let me finish this off and then I'll take questions. Okay, the replacement of truth. Three points under C. Point number one is to note the exchange that occurs. Verse 25, verse 23. Start with verse 23. They exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for likeness of an image of corruptible man. Verse 25, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie. You've got two verbs there, one of which is a compound of the other, alasso, which means to change. Verse 23, verse 25, the exchange, which is to say, as Lewis has said repeatedly, as Chuck Colson repeatedly says, we are constituted to require an object of worship. And so what's going on here is not an abandonment of worship. It's an exchange of one kind of worship for another. Thomas Aquinas was right that a human being cannot live without gods. And so if the true God is abandoned, false gods will be exalted in his place. Peter Kraft has pointed out that contemporary American culture has three dominant gods in place of the true God. And one of them is Molech. Who is Molech? What did Molech require? Child sacrifice. Abortion on demand. What about Ashtoreth? Yeah. Exalting sexuality into a goddess. And Mammon, Molech, Ashtoreth, and Mammon pretty well covers the pantheon in contemporary American culture. The worship of money, the worship of sex, and such a self-centeredness that even a product of one's own body can be offered up in sacrifice. That's all point number one. Point number two is to note the selfishness of the exchange. Behind idolatry, as depicted here, There doesn't seem to be so much of an inconsolable longing to make contact with the ultimately transcendent as it does to exchange the transcendent for something close at hand. Who is deified in ancient idolatry? The idolater. In ancient idolatry, behavior dictates belief. So if I determine I want to live according to a kind of sexuality according on my own terms, the way to do that is to conceive a religion that will sanction that kind of behavior. And so it's not accidental that sexuality and ancient idolatry are inextricably bound together. Look at verse 23. Images made to look like mortal man. They exchanged the truth of God and worshiped and served the creature. And who is the main creature that is worshiped? Not a lion or a giraffe or an alligator, but the human self. That's why C.K. Barrett says this: "The immediate result of this rebellion was a state of corruption in which men were no longer capable of distinguishing between themselves and God, and accordingly fell into idolatry, behind which in all its forms lies in the last resort the idolization of the self." See his commentary on Romans. And now thirdly, this is point three, III, under the replacement of truth. And this is a point well made by Karl Barth in his Church Dogmatics and underscored by James Dunn in his recently published A Theology of Paul the Apostle. Point three is religion as unbelief. We might be tempted to think that Romans 1:18-32 describes an abandonment of religion, but it's just the opposite. It's seeking refuge from God in religion. I have to confess that I like to watch Seinfeld. And in a recent episode, I don't know whether it was a rerun or a newly run, Elaine had begun going out with, I guess, what could be described as a Jesus freak. And then, because she couldn't get anything but Christian contemporary music on his radio, and then she and Seinfeld and what's his name, George, I guess Cosmo was absent, were having a discussion about this, and it was as though this man were religious, but everybody else in this present conversation was not. Whereas Paul says, man is deeply and incurably religious. It just depends on what you're going to do with that religious impulse. And James Dunn says that Romans 1:18-32 describes misdirected religion. Is it not true that according to Romans, the chief rival to God's revelation is human religion? And one of the gravest dangers in the Christian church is the intrusion of a human manufacture that will replace the gospel. Why did Karl Barth write his commentary on Romans in the first place? As an antidote to classical liberalism. And that's why, Karl Heim said that Barth's epistle to the Romans commentary fell like a bombshell on the playground of the theologians, for whom religion had become a substitute for revelation from God. It can happen in the evangelical tradition. Preach the gospel to yourself every day. Here's a quote from Karl Barth: "The substitute for honoring God appropriately is religion." Listen, what's the great contrast in Romans? Righteousness of God and what? righteousness of men. Romans 10, verse 3, they being ignorant of the righteousness of God and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves to the righteousness of God. If you enter your study of Romans recognizing that the great enemy of the gospel is religion, this message will make its impact. Here's a further statement from Barth. From the standpoint of revelation, religion is clearly seen to be a human attempt to anticipate what God in His revelation wills to do and does do. It is the attempted replacement of the divine work by a human manufacture. Religion as unbelief. Think about it. That will become even plainer, will it not, when we get to Romans chapter 2, the Jewish religion. Okay. Point D, the motive. What is the fundamental motive underlying all the things we were just talking about? If you had to put it in one word, what would you say? One word, either English or Greek. Well, let's stick with English. What's the fundamental explanation for all of the things that are indicted in this passage? What'd you say? What's the motive for the rebellion? Aha! What's the deadliest of the deadly sins? Hubris, pride. That's why I wrote a whole chapter on the subject, chapter 5. I know I've said this before. You go up Mount Purgatory where you overcome the seven deadly sins, and the first one to be addressed is pride, because unless pride is conquered, the others cannot be. Pride, by its very nature, is a desire to compete with God for the sovereignty of one's life. Pride is congenitally competitive, and the chief competitor for pride is God. That's why we suppress the truth about Him. He's too real. He's too glorious. We cannot tolerate that kind of truth. Because if we let God be God, then we've got to be submissive to Him. Why is it that some scientists can recognize all the flaws in Darwinian evolution and still embrace it, because the alternative is too real? What are the effects? This is the last thing I want to talk about today. If we don't have time for your questions, write them out and I'll deal with them next time. First of all, the revelation of the wrath of God. Three things under A. First, the source of wrath. C.H. Dodd made the celebrated comment that Romans 1:18 does not describe the attitude of God to man, but an inevitable process of cause and effect in a moral universe. And that judgment has been universally rejected. It's the wrath of God, orge theou. The wrath is revealed from heaven, not from within the natural order. And the wrath of God is just as personal as the righteousness of God. Just as personal. Point two, the character of wrath. God's wrath must not be confused with the vindictive rage of a capricious pagan deity. And we're not to understand God's wrath in light of our wrath, our rage, our impulses. Instead, we can say that the wrath of God is the settled, unswerving opposition of His holy nature to all that is evil. It's the settled, unswerving opposition of His holy nature against all that is evil. notice that the object of his wrath is ungodliness and wickedness. It doesn't mean that the human beings escape its effects, but the immediate object is ungodliness. Please remember that when we come to chapter 3, where God's wrath is poured out upon sin, which Christ has taken upon himself. And then, point 3, the exercise of wrath. Please notice that Romans 1:18 describes an activity. The wrath of God actually goes forth from heaven. Just as the righteousness of God goes forth in the gospel. Please notice how Paul expresses this. Just follow along in your English text. Verse 24, verse 26, verse 28. Wherefore, God handed them over. Verse 26. Wherefore, God handed them over. Verse 28. God handed them over. In all three cases, verb, object, definite article, subject. There's something deeply tragic about this. Notice how wrath exercises itself. By allowing human beings to become ever more deeply ensnared and enslaved by their sin. Some of you may have homosexual friends. Can you read verse 27 without weeping? In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. That judgment arises from within the activity itself. That's why I think it was C.S. Lewis who said, you know, we should judge those who help propagate this kind of activity, such as the TV show Ellen, but how could you have anything but pity when you realize what homosexuality does to the homosexual? Remember Galatians 6, verse 8. He that sows to the flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. Sin has its own penalty built in. Let's see. Let me just start this next section to try to keep on track. And several of you have raised your hands. Write out your questions. I'll deal with them next time. We may not have time even to finish this. The degeneration of mankind, 3 points. Number one, the darkening of the heart. The darkening of the heart. Chapter 1, verse 21. Right at the end of verse 21. Look at this. Knowing God, they did not glorify Him as God. End of verse 21. Their foolish heart was darkened. That's a passive verb, divine passive. They suppress the truth about God. What is the judgment? Their foolish heart was darkened, especially in its cognitive dimension. How can you read that and not think of the phrase Aufklärung, enlightenment? You know, reason is enthroned. Paul says the enthroning of reason, the age of enlightenment, is in fact a darkening of the intellect. The very fact that you enthrone reason shows how foolish you are.
You have reached the end of this lesson. Please continue listening to this side for the next lesson.
Please turn in your syllabus to page 140. If you have not yet gotten the handout on 2 Corinthians, please get a copy. And let me remind you that I need those exams returned. Page 140, then, of the syllabus. Please turn to Romans chapter 1. We were noting the effects of the human rebellion according to Romans 1:18-32. The first effect, the revelation of the wrath of God. And we need to keep in mind that when Paul uses language like to reveal and to manifest, he's not talking merely about disclosure, but activity. So the revelation of the wrath of God means that people actually experience that wrath. And we had begun to talk about the degeneration of mankind. And I had mentioned the first of three matters under B. The first was the darkening of the heart. Chapter 1, verse 21. And we looked at Paul's language in relation to the language of enlightenment. The tragic irony is that those who consider themselves to be enlightened are in fact darkened. And the very enthronement of reason witnesses to the darkening of the heart. The second point here I want to underscore is that sin is parasitic. Sin is a parasite. Write the word down, even if you don't understand what I mean. This point has been made by theologians through the centuries, not least Augustine. It has been very eloquently highlighted in a recent book by Cornelius Plantinga, Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, A Breviary of Sin. And he has a whole chapter on sin as a parasite. Sin is not an original thing. Sin must feed on something good. If you look at the catalog of vices in Romans 1:18-32, they all represent perversions or reversals of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. Let me just illustrate by taking three terms from verses 29 and 30. One of the evils is greed or covetousness. Greed feeds on a prior good, namely the goodness of God's creation. In one sense, greed is easy to understand because God's creations are so delightful and so engrossing and so attractive. So this deadly sin feeds off the goodness of creation. Or notice the language of verse 30. God haters. There's a reversal or perversion of the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. You have to have the good, glorious, majestic God there before you have a capacity for hating him. And then likewise in verse 30, they disobey their parents. Honor your father and your mother. Unless that commandment is there, you don't have an object for the parasitic work of sin. Well, I commend to you Plantinga's book on that subject. And then, thirdly, is to note the progressive degeneration recorded here, the downward spiral in verses 18 through 32. From idolatry to sexual sins, and within that realm, sexual immorality, first of a heterosexual, then of a homosexual kind, and then to sins that affect every area of life and society. Could there be a more vivid expose of contemporary cultural sin than Romans 1:18-32? If these passages sink in, we will flee to the gospel when we meet it in chapter 3, verse 21. Now turn to page 141. We're coming to Romans 2, verses 1 through 29, the judgment of the judges. First of all, the human judges. Chapter 2, verse 1, "You therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else, for at whatever point you judge the other, you are condemning yourself, because you who pass judgment do the same things." Let me try to boil down for you some of the discussion on this. I'm taking the view that the judges who are indicted already in chapter 2, verse 1, are especially Jews, if not exclusively so. F.F. Bruce would include noble Gentile moralists like Seneca, but especially the Jews are in view here, as they are explicitly in verse 17. "Now you, if you call yourself a Jew," and so on. Let me give you four reasons for this judgment that Paul is especially addressing his fellow Jews here. 4 points then under A. Number one, the affinities between 2:1-16, and the Jewish Book of Wisdom, a book that you might profitably read for light on intertestamental Judaism in the setting of this letter. The affinities between Romans 2:1-16 and the Jewish Book of Wisdom. If you take out James Dunn's commentary on Romans, he'll give you lots of quotations from that. Number two, the language of verse 4 as expressive of God's long-suffering toward Israel, both in Old Testament times and now. "Do you show contempt for the riches of His kindness, tolerance, and patience?" Is not that an apt threefold summary of Yahweh's attitude toward Old Testament Israel? Chapter 2, verse 4. His kindness, tolerance, and patience. Read the opening chapters of Hosea for the incredible long-suffering tenderness of Yahweh toward His adulterous wife, Israel. And then number three, the Jews' typical sense of moral superiority to Gentiles. The Jews' typical sense of moral superiority to Gentiles. And if you read verses 18-20, that notion is elaborated. "If you know His will and approve of what is superior because you are instructed by the law," etc. The Jews referred with contempt to those uncircumcised, benighted Gentiles. And then number four, the connection between chapter 2 and verses 18-32 of chapter 1. The connection between this passage and the preceding. Notice the opening, "therefore." "Un," at the beginning of chapter 2, verse 1. If you regard 1:18-32 as an indictment of Gentiles exclusively, that "therefore" doesn't make sense. But please notice that nowhere in chapter 1, verses 18-32, does Paul speak of Gentiles or nations or Greeks. Verses 18-32 apply with equal validity to Jews as well as to Gentiles. Indeed, what is the dominant sin of Old Testament Israel? If you've been listening to Drs. Currid and Davis, what's the dominant sin? Idolatry, going after the Baals, the Ashtaroth, and so on. Look at chapter 1, verse 23. Exchange the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. Listen to Psalm 106, verse 20. They exchanged their glory for an image of a bull which eats grass. That's an indictment of Israeli apostasy and idolatry. Read Deuteronomy chapter 4, these urgent warnings against idolatry. So, therefore, in 2:1 makes sense because Paul has been indicting Jewish religion in the preceding passage. Now, coming to the next point, Paul's argument. 2 points under B. For us to understand this chapter, we must recognize that Paul is in process of developing a lengthy, closely knit argument. He's speaking as Jew to Jew. And some commentators have suggested, I think correctly, that reflected here in Romans 2 is a history of debates in the Jewish synagogues between Paul, the former Pharisee, and some of the scribes and rabbis within Israel. That's the first point. He's in the midst of developing an argument, and he's speaking as Jew to Jew in much the same way as he would do in a debate in a synagogue of the diaspora. Point number two, Paul is here not expounding the gospel, but preparing for that exposition. And the burden of Romans chapter 2 is that on Jewish presuppositions, there's no more hope of salvation for them than for the Gentiles whom they condemn. We come then to the divine judge. Several times in this passage, Paul speaks of God's activity as a judge. Chapter 2, verse 2. Now we know that God's judgment is based on truth. Verse 3. Do you think you will escape God's judgment? Verse 5. When his righteous judgment will be revealed. Let me notice with you four features of that judgment. The first is that his judgment is inescapable. He uses this very language in verse 3. So when you, a mere man, pass judgment on them and yet do the same things, do you think you will escape God's judgment? The verb is ekphugo, from which we get the word fugitive, one who flees. Do you imagine you will escape God's judgment? Notice also verse 5. Because of your stubbornness and your unrepentant heart, you're storing up wrath against yourself for the day of God's wrath, when his righteous judgment will be revealed. We do not know when the day will arrive, but its certainty is assured. Secondly, his judgment is universal, embracing both Jews and Gentiles. Look at verse 9. There will be trouble and distress for every human being who does evil, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. But glory, honor, and peace for everyone who does good, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. Also the language of verse 16. God will judge the secrets of men. Anthropon, a term that embraces both Gentiles and Jews. Thirdly, his judgment is revealing. Chapter 2, verse 16. God will judge the secrets of men. And the language of 16 is noteworthy, because in Judaism there was often a discrepancy between the outward action and the inward desire. Compare chapter 7, verses 7 to 11. Which of the Ten Commandments pierced Paul to the heart and penetrated all of his ego defense mechanisms? Which was the sin that he focused upon there in chapter 7? I would not have known covetousness if the law had not said, "You shall not covet." Francis Schaeffer somewhere says that breaking the 10th commandment is the preparation for breaking the other 9. You know, you first covet your neighbor's wife, and then you commit adultery. You first covet what your neighbor possesses, and then you steal it. You first covet the supremacy of the universe, and then you deny the reality and supremacy of God. Compared to 1 Corinthians 4, verse 5. The Lord will bring to light what is hidden in darkness. There's a good illustration of this in the novel The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. Anybody here read that? Marvelous use of the English language, though I wouldn't recommend Oscar Wilde's lifestyle. But the Picture of Dorian Gray, the title is really a digest of the book. Dorian Gray was a beautiful, talented, effervescent young Englishman whose life degenerated in a succession of debauchery. There was a portrait painted of him in his younger years that was placed in an attic, and later the portrait was drawn from the attic, and his whole visage had become that of a monster, even though his actual visage had remained unchanged. So the picture illustrated the deterioration of his life in a way that was not immediately evident when you saw the man himself. God will bring to light what we have made of ourselves in rebellion against him. And then his judgment is impartial. Verse 11, God does not show favoritism. What's the Greek word translated there, favoritism? You remember your principal parts, lampsia, lambano, lampsomai, eleban. What's lambano? To receive. What's prosopa? Yeah, respective persons literally means to receive faces. God looks on the heart, man looks on the outward appearance. That's the very word used there in James 2, verse 1. Do not show respect of persons. Don't favor the rich over the poor. Very interesting that the corresponding adjective, prosalampsos, is used in Acts 10, 34, Peter's visit to the house of Cornelius. God is no respecter of person, but in every nation he that does righteousness is received by him. So, God's judgment is not based upon externals. You see how this relates to the previous point about the revelatory character bringing to light the motives of the heart. And then we come to, well, let me just add one thing before we leave that point. Within the context of chapter 2, the emphasis in verse 11 seems to be that Jews cannot expect to receive favorable treatment at the last judgment. God will show them no partiality. Indeed, it might be argued that given his manifold grace to Old Testament Israel, they will be treated with exceptional severity. See Amos chapter 3. Verse 2, you only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will judge you for your iniquity.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.